This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Rhiannon Giddens has an impressive resume. She has a degree in opera from Oberlin Conservatory. She's appeared on soundtracks for hit movies and TV shows, and she has a Grammy. But even those achievements don't adequately define her music. Rhiannon's roots lie in North Carolina's Piedmont. She grew up around Greensboro, where she stood out in youth choirs. Her voice took her to one of the finest music schools in the country, but she eventually made the jump from opera to old-time music. Through legendary North Carolina fiddler Joe Thompson, she met the rest of the Carolina Chocolate Drops and learned the traditions of black string music. Rhiannon Giddens still performs with the Drops and recently released her first solo album called Tomorrow Is My Turn. Rhiannon plays at the Schaefer Center for the Performing Arts in Boone on Thursday, September 24th, and then at Page Auditorium in Durham, Friday, September 25th. And right now, Rhiannon Giddens joins me on our studio on the State of Things. Welcome back. Good to have you here.
Good to be here.
You know, we've never really gotten to talk about the, as many times you've been on the show, about the kind of deep history and how you got to love music and when it all started back in Greensboro. Were you always singing and loving music?
Yeah, as far as I know. I mean, the family lore has me, you know, in the crib, you know, singing and making up songs. And so, it's just been a part of my life since I can remember.
How about your parents? Were they involved in music? Did they, you know, sort of encourage you?
Oh, definitely. I mean, the whole family is musical. And, you know, my dad is actually a music education major at UNCG and has a fabulous voice. And my mom's a huge music appreciator and singer herself, and my sister. So, you know, definitely music was, you know, a huge part of growing up.
And the fact is that the fact that your father was a music teacher and concentrated on voice is part of the reason why you didn't have a lot of early professional training. Is that right?
Well, I had the best training of all, which was singing with my dad, singing with my sister. Like, you know, he trained me the best way, I think, by ear, in that we just sang a lot together. And he didn't, like, bother trying to, you know, teach me how to read music or any of that stuff, which I really appreciate, because you can always learn how to read music, but developing that ear and that just love of music, I think, is for me, it was the best way for me to have it.
And you kind of had an instinct for picking up the harmonies, right?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I remember the first day I started trying to write a harmony to a tune, you know, and like had the tune in my mind and was writing a harmony to. I remember that really clearly. It was just like this discovery of, oh my gosh, you know.
If only I knew how to write music.
Right.
Caught you.
If only I had an iPhone to record into.
Will you join the Greensboro? Was it the Greensboro Youth Choir?
Mm-hmm.
And so you were clearly ready to go out and sing out, right?
Yeah, I mean,
that's middle school.
That was my first sort of public, I'd say, you know, going out into public. I mean, before then, it was just really around the house and with the family and Christmas carols and that kind of thing. And that was a really great early grounding. You know, she really taught us discipline and expected a lot of us. You know, Ann Doyle was really wonderful, back then, I thought she was real hard, you know, but now I appreciate so much how much she expected us to excel. You know, we were kids, but like she didn't let up. And I think we did hard music and it was really good training for now that when I got to Oberlin, I kind of realized what I'd gotten, you know, in the mm-hmm. GYC. And I really, really appreciate it. I think she's really fabulous.
Between that youth choir and Oberlin, though, there was you had some thoughts of being an artist, right?
Yeah, I mean, even in GYC, I never thought, oh, I'm going to be a professional musician. It was just like, this is really fun. Yeah. I like doing this. And I was always an artist, and everybody thought that's what I was going to do. That's what I thought I was going to do. I was going to work for Disney, you know, or Pixar.
We all work for Disney.
Eventually we all will. But I drew all the time, and then I got into science, and I wanted to be a physicist before I knew what that really meant.
Well, you went to some good schools before, so talk about that education.
I went to the it was a magnet technology magnet school. It was a math science technology magnet at Dudley High School in Greensboro for 2 years, and then I went to the School of Science and Mathematics in Durham for 2 years. So yeah, I definitely got my fill of science and math.
And it's interesting because you applied to the governor's school, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you went to the School of Science. But was that a choice that you had to make?
No, the governor's school is a summer school.
Got it.
So like as a rising senior, I got into the choir. At Governor's School, and that's where the bug bit me. I was surrounded by choir kids who were, you know, more grown than when I was in middle school, and just went, oh, this is, I want to sing for a living. And then I went back to science and math, and I started a cappella group called Contus there my senior year and started auditioning for schools.
You still in touch with any of them?
I am. Well, cool. Facebook is a wonderful thing.
Well, talk about that application process, because you got a full ride to Carnegie Mellon, right?
I did. I got a scholarship. I couldn't believe it, you know, and I thought, well, this is where I'm going, you know, and Oberlin, I don't know what's going to happen. You know, are they going to let me in or whatever? Because I heard from Carnegie Mellon first, and I got into Oberlin too. And what kind of decided me was, you know, I knew that in opera they sang all the time, and musical theater they don't. You have to speak, and I hated speaking in public.
Oh, really?
So I said, I'm going to go where you just got to sing. You know, that's all you got to worry about. Little did I know what I was getting myself into. But I was approached by a teacher at Oberlin, Marlene Rosen, who one of my teacher here had told me, if you get into there, she's the teacher to go to, and she's the one who approached me. So I thought, it's the universe telling me this is it.
Well,
you know, so.
I mean, even though the deal was a little better at Carnegie Mellon,
it was,
that would have been theater,
musical theater. Yeah.
And a little bit different. So what about the music you were interested in? I mean, all of a sudden we're going from the arts, or, you know, from the youth choir arts and then opera. What were your interests at home? Because you come from an interracial background. Mm-hmm. Your parents, were they listening? What kind of music were you listening to at home?
Well, I got exposed to a lot of stuff. I mean, my mom just is a huge music appreciator and good sound system, and like, don't touch the bows, you know? And it was just like, it was really great. I got, you know, she loved Andre Segovia, so I would have heard some of that. And then I was, you know, we were all into modern country, so I was really listening to a lot of pop country. And then I was into They Might Be Giants, and I was getting my own kind of, you know, thing. So it was always eclectic, you know, and I think that really helped build sort of my appreciation for all the different things that I do even now.
When you do a thing like study opera, mm-hmm. you go to a place like Oberlin, I mean, what's your aspiration at that moment? What do you think that's going
to
be?
Oh, you're
going
to sing at the Met.
I mean,
you don't go to a conservatory unless you think, I'm going to be a soloist, you know, standing in front of thousands of people, you know, with fancy costumes, and you know, and that's what you have to, that's what you have, because it is so much work. And I loved it. I just went in there and I was like, I just have to take music classes. I mean, it was like a dream come true. I mean, it was a lot of work, because I didn't know how to read music. You know, I had like the rudiments, the very, very rudiments of musical education, and I was behind most of the other people there. And I really think it gave me an appreciation. You know, it wasn't like I was surrounded by this stuff since I was four. Like, I came to it late, so I really did it because I was loving it, not just because it was part of my life, you know. And I think I'm really grateful for that, because I have this sort of fresh appreciation for classical music, you know, that a lot of the people there were already jaded, you know, about it. So,
well, how much singing have they done? Because, again, you weren't really at it in that professional way. And I'm thinking that people, kids who go to the conservatory, they've done a lot of singing before they get there. Is that
well,
not
Well, some
true?
Have, some haven't. I mean, the voice is different than to instruments, you know, because you have to have a certain maturity to it to sing this stuff. And even in college, you're not really old enough to sing a lot of the repertoire. You have to wait till you're in your 30s or your 40s, you know. So there was definitely less of that, you know, I've been doing this since I was four, you know, amongst the vocalists. But there's still that, you know, a lot of people already had, you know, knew a lot of the repertoire and had been preparing for doing this, you know, a lot more than I had.
And what about the repertoire? I mean, again, you've expressed the fact that you loved the eclectic taste that you were exposed to, the various kinds of music. Was opera something you really loved as a form itself?
I mean, what I knew of it, I had like one compilation CD, you know, and I'd seen one on TV, and what I heard, I really liked, you know. And once I started getting into it, I just went, oh my God, this stuff is beautiful. Mm. I really fell in love with the art form, with art song, with, you know, and digging into the history of it. Whenever I did a role, I always, it's kind of like you see it now, what I do now, you know, starting there, like I was like, okay, if this girl grew up in 18th century France, let me research 18th century France, you know, what are her motivations? I mean, I really got into it, you know, and so it's not a terrible surprise that I ended up, you know, doing what I do.
Well, and the other thing, and we'll talk more about how you made that transition in a few minutes, but I want to hear about because I think in a program like that, you also learn about the human voice. You don't just learn to sing. You really are learning about the human voice. And I would think some of that would be surprising and wonderful. Was it? I mean, it would be for me. I'd love to know what I'm doing right now, and I don't.
Yeah, I mean, just, you know, there was a great vocal studio or art vocal. Like, I got scoped, you know, you get a little camera down the back of your throat.
Ooh.
And I watched my vocal folds. You know, that kind of stuff is really interesting, and I think gives you an appreciation for what your voice can do, you know, in ways that other things can't. I mean, because you are seeing what's happening, knowing the mechanics of what's going on. I've been able to apply that to everything that I've done since, you know, which has been wonderful.
Note to staff, we're going to start live streaming my vocal cords and nasal passages beginning tomorrow on the State of Things. So just stateofthings.org, live streaming Frank's vocal cords. I think it's a great idea.
Yeah, absolutely.
We just have to get some of the technology in here. Yeah. I'm going to continue my conversation with Rhiannon Giddens on the State of Things, co-founder of the Carolina Chocolate Drops, plays at Chafer Center for the Performing Arts in Boone on the 24th and Page Auditorium on the 25th. You know we've got all that at our website. And our conversation continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us.
I am a country girl. I've been around the world, and every place I've been, ain't got nothing like living in the South. Oh, honey, shut your mouth. I am a country girl. I am a country girl. All day I dream about a place in the sun, kind of like where I'm from, with the tall grass blowing in the breeze, running barefoot round the tall oak tree. All day I dream about a place I've been, a place where the skin I'm in feels like it's supposed to be. And anyone around who looks at me says, I am a country girl. I've been around the world, and every place I've been ain't quite nothing like living in the South. Oh, and I shut your mouth. I am a country girl. I am a country girl.
This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest, Rhiannon Giddens. She's from Greensboro, co-founder of the Grammy-winning group Carolina Chocolate Drops, and she's going to play at Chase Center for the Performing Arts in Boone on Thursday, September 24th. She'll be at Page Auditorium Friday the 25th, and she's doing some solo work now. We're talking about how she got there. So you go to Oberlin, came back to North Carolina. Mm-hmm. What was your expectation? What were you thinking at the time when you finished Oberlin?
I was burnt out. Yeah. You know, cause that's the other thing. I'm starting from scratch. I'm going from basically 0 to 60. I mean, ended up doing a lot of roles and recitals and sang a lot and learned a lot. And then I was like, done. I was like, I got to take a break, you know? And so I came back home. I was going to go to grad school, and I said, you know, I'm going to put that off and just regroup, you know? So I came back, and I did end up enrolling in UNCG for a year, and did a wonderful, you know, year, a couple of operas, and that was really great. It was kind of my last hurrah. Because while that was happening, I was discovering, you know, what I, you know, came to discover as the sort of my meaning, my job here on this world. And that came through contra dancing. So, you know, I came home, I was exhausted, I was like really burnt out, and I discovered the contra dance community in Winston-Salem, in the Triangle, and Greensboro, and just fell in love, absolutely, and became a dance gypsy. And that was my entryway into old-time music, was through the dancing.
How much did you know about contra dancing, and what was it about it that really attracted you?
Well, I had started dancing at Oberlin, actually. I'd seen a flyer for what I thought was English country dance. You know, I'm a big Austin fan, and that's what they do in the Austin novels. And so I went,
You thought you were going to jump into the pages of a Jane Austen novel.
Basically. Okay. And I jumped into, you know, pages of 200 years ago in America. I loved it, and so I started contra dancing up at Oberlin until I couldn't anymore because the opera rehearsals got in the way. Mm. And I told a friend of mine, Becky, about contra dancing, and she started contra dancing down here. So when I came back home, she was like, oh, there's a great community down here. And I was like, oh, great. You know, so I started dancing again, and I was dancing like 2-3 times a week. I was traveling. Wow. And that's where I fell in love with the banjo. There's a lot of great old time bands in this area who play for those dances, mm-hmm. as well as Celtic bands and Canadian band, you know, Canadian music. And so I was exposed to all these different kinds of trad music that I hadn't heard. And that's where it started. I started calling dances, writing dances, then I started playing dances. You know, it was a huge part of my development.
I know that the dancing part is great because, you know, you're getting out, you're really expressing yourself. That's a lot of fun. But the fact that you got so involved in the music, given the repertoire that you'd been, you know, trained on, did that come as a surprise to you? All of a sudden you're actually writing contra dances?
No, it just, you know, it was a new thing that I loved, you know, and it's kind of a pattern that I've followed in my life. You know, I find something and I don't just like get into it. I really get into it, you know. So like, you know, I just ate, slept, breathed and drank contra dancing trad music, and, you know, became, and, you know, I think coming into it through dance was really important because it gave me this appreciation for the rhythms and the, you know, just what that dance music is for, which is for dancing, you know. So when I started playing it and then also playing with Joe, which we'll talk about, I'm sure, you know, starting that and being a vocalist my whole life, you know, starting my instrumental life as a dance fiddler or banjo player or whatever, I think is really important because, you know, it just, you release all of your ego and you turn into a machine kind of, you know, you're there for the dancers. And it just kind of puts you in the right place in a lot of ways.
Well, and think about the foundations that you're building. I mean, you understand what the voice is. You understand the roots of this. You've danced to the music. You've embodied it. Mm-hmm. And now, yeah, you can let go, right? I mean, because it's you've internalized it, you know.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, yeah.
Including at the Macaroni Grill.
Yes. That is how I bought my first banjo, was as my second job. I was a graphic designer by day. And, I sang, you know, O Sole Mio or whatever. I didn't sing that. That's a male song. But I would sing, you know, simple Italian arias for people if they wanted them. And hope
at the Macaroni Grill?
At the Macaroni freaking Grill.
Do they do this?
That is the thing. It's the singing hostess. Yeah. I mean, they're, you know, if you can find them, people do it. And you can request a song.
Wow.
You know? And so as soon as I got enough money to buy an instrument, I quit.
Well, kind of don't blame you there.
Yeah.
You bought the banjo. How much did you know? Because now you've really made it a big part of your career to understand and teach the history of string music in America and bring back some of what had been lost. Mm-hmm. How much did you know at that point before you bought your banjo?
Nothing. I mean, I knew what everybody knows. It's, you know, it's a hillbilly instrument and hee-haw and all that. So I used to watch hee-haw growing up, you know. Mm-hmm. And when I discovered the old time, you know, rather than the bluegrass, which, I appreciated bluegrass banjo, but hearing the old time, that clawhammer sound, that really plunky kind of thing, I just fell in love with that first. And then I started, you know, I got C.C. Conway's book, African Echoes in Appalachia, African Banjo Echoes in Appalachia, and started learning the history of the banjo and then getting recordings of old black string bands and just kind of like my mind was blown. And then it was like on, you know.
Yeah.
I loved it. I knew that the music drew me and some sort of ineffable quality of the banjo drew me. And then when I knew the history, I was, you know, because before then I kind of felt like an interloper, you know. I was like, hi, can I join your jam? Mm-hmm. You know, it's not really my music, but I really like it. But, you know, then I was like, ow, it is my music. It's everybody's music, you know. And that was a huge sort of, you know, kind of like opening for me. I was just like, my world is opened now. It's amazing.
Well, that's what gets confusing for folks because I think we'll talk a little bit about the history for those who don't, you know kind of what we're talking about yet, the roots of the banjo, how it got lost, and then how it got recovered. But once you lose it, because it's an instrument that came here from Africa and was associated with African music and African-American culture pre-emancipation, it gets lost, and I'll let you tell more of the story. But then you have to retell the story, so it is everybody's music. In the end, it's everybody's, but we do need to bring the story back, and that means a particular telling of the story from a particular point of view.
No, we do. I mean, you know, because you have, banjo ancestors, like, you know, West African instruments that would have come over. It is an American instrument because the banjo, as we know it, is formed in America, but it is absolutely attached to the African-American experience because first 100 years of its existence, it was known as a plantation instrument. It was not played by the white community at all, that we know of, you know, other than maybe isolated incidents that we don't know of. But it was only until, you know, the 1840s and 50s that really it took off amongst white entertainers. And then minstrelsy, as we know it, was born. And well, it was, you know, that comes a little earlier, but as we think of it, you know, with banjos and fiddle and tambourine and all that stuff. And that is really the heart of the birth of American entertainment, music, dance. I mean, it's huge. And, you know, minstrelsy is the most popular form of entertainment for over like 80 years or something like that. It's insane how big a part it plays in the creation of the American identity, how big a part it plays in the creation of the American identity in the eyes of the world, because it was the first American cultural export, you know, 100 years before rock and roll. I mean, that's the first American music that the rest of the world heard was minstrel music with banjo, you know, and it's just like... The fact that that was such a huge part of our history, and the fact that it's so little known, and that it's has such a small, tiny presence in sort of our overall picture of what American music is, just boggles my mind. And it's just, sorry, you can tell I get really passionate about it.
No, and you should. And the fact that it was it performed as stereotype and as caricature is part of the reason that it fell out of favor among African Americans at that point. Am I right about that?
Well, there's that. You know, you have the Great Migration, you know, and you have new forms of music coming. What we've kind of lost, you know, in our dialogue about black music is we go from spirituals and work songs, and then we skip ahead to, you know, the jazz and blues, you know? And it's like there's this huge time period where you had black minstrels, you know, because the only job in entertainment you could get it was as a minstrel. So you had black people blacking up to be caricatures of themselves, you know, but then subverting it in lots of ways, and how that, you know, was at the heart of the creation of black entertainment. And you can still see that today. I mean, it's just... You know, it's very, very complicated. It wasn't just because of that the banjo fell out of favor. It was, you know, there's the music was moving on. It was, you know, new instruments were coming in, taking the place. You know, it's really complicated. But what is really important is who's writing the history here and who's writing the music history, and how, you know, my issue is not so much that it fell out of favor in the black community, but that the history and the knowledge of it completely disappeared. And that distresses me, because, you know, we really need to know, everybody needs to know that, but we really need to know it too, you know, that this is like the fact that we have, that the Carolina Chocolate Drops has been in existence for 10 years, and we've never gotten a major black publication, an interview in a magazine, you know, anything other than Tavis Smiley, and that was problematic because of his ignorance of the music, you know. The fact that that hasn't happened, you know, I'm just starting to get interest now as a solo artist, you know, from that realm, you know, is troubling to me, and it's always been troubling to all of us, you know, in the Carolina Chocolate Drops. So anyway,
I appreciate all that, because that's it is part of the deep history, and you know, thanks to you and others, and we'll talk about Joe Thompson in a minute. Though I'd like to ask you to play, if you would, do a traditional banjo song, and then we'll go back to your mentor, Joe Thompson.
I was going to play a fiddle tune, if that's all right.
Oh, yeah, fiddle. Yeah. That'd be great.
This is one I learned from Joe. Now, he would never play without a banjo player, but I'm going to do that in this instance.
Rhiannon Giddens, live on The State of Things. Her latest album is called Tomorrow Is My Turn. Tell us, what do you know about that song?
I learned it from Joe.
Well, talk about Joe Thompson. How did you meet Joe? Tell us, remind us who he was, the late Joe Thompson, and how important he was to you, and also how you met him.
And Joe Thompson was African-American fiddler from Mebane, and one of the last that we know of who played in the old style. He played for the square dances in his youth. The whole you know, neighborhood, he played for the white dances and the black dances as part of the Thompson family band. He and his brother, was fiddle and banjo, and it was a real honor and blessing, you know, to meet him, because you hear, like, as a person of color, to know that this music that you love so much, you know, started in your community and had, you know, this history in your community, to know that is one thing, but to actually see an elder, you know, of a lineage, you know, that was passed down from father to son, to see that and to be a part of that and to feel that was just, it was really kind of priceless. You know, we're so lucky that we got to play with him. And, you know, we did take the time to do it. You know, nobody forced us down there, but also that he was so open, and all of the people who had played with him, because, you know, by the time we met him, he was the last member of his family left playing this music. And there's a group of the white musical community around him who had, you know, been playing with him and sort of protecting him and keeping him, you know, going, which is just really wonderful. So that by the time we came, you know, he was still playing, you know, and we're really lucky to meet him. I mean, the three of us met him at the Black Banjo Gathering, me, Dom, and Justin, and, you know, decided to start playing with him and going down on Thursday nights. And, just playing his tunes.
You knew a lot about music then. What did you learn from Joe?
It's hard to put into words what I learned from Joe. You know, I can tell you all day long what I learned at school, but, you know, I think that the way that I play music, the way that I sing, the way that I approach music, you know, is changed forever because of playing with Joe. You know, could have been like my grandfather, my family's from Ebon. You know, there's all these connections, and when you think about just the air molecules change when you play with somebody, you know? Yeah. And so you don't even know what you're getting really until it's gone. And you go, wow, you know, you can't get that from a recording. Yeah. You know, you can get a lot of things from a recording, but just, you know, hearing the stories and just feeling that this was a part of his life. He wasn't a performer back then, you know? I mean, he became one, but this was a part of his life, the fabric of his community. And just to kind of hear about that and to know that, like, deeply, you know, I think that that's one of the reasons. I mean, all three of us, you know, really wanted the music to be the star in our band, you know, and that continues for me today. It's like, it's not about me. It's about the music, and it's about the message and whatever's coming through us, you know. And I think starting off with Joe really helped tap into that, you know.
Joe Thompson, we have an actual clip of a song that he did, Old Corn Liquor. Let's listen to some of that. Late Joe Thompson playing a song called Old Corn Liquor. I'm talking today with Rhiannon Giddens, co-founder of the Carolina Chocolate Drops. She's going to be at the Shea Center for the Performing Arts in Boone on Thursday the 24th and Page Auditorium in Durham on the 25th. A song like that, I mean, you'd say that he's not really, wasn't really a performer, but I mean, in the sense that he wasn't doing concerts and things. It was parties, right?
Right, party, yeah. It was function music. Yeah. You know, it was music for the dancing. And, you know, you're serving somebody. You're serving the great, you know, you're serving the community, really, when you do that. And that's a very different thing than I'm going to get on stage and do this for all these people, you know, which that's important too, but, you know.
And what about the repertoire? Where did those songs come from? I mean, we talk about the origins and the kind of roots of banjo coming from West Africa in some ways, but then the music, once it gets here.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the, you know, dance music in the States, I mean, it's all these different cultural influences that come together, and, you know, the fiddle and banjo being, you know, one of the earliest dance bands in this country, you know, would have been plantation bands that would have been playing for the big house or playing for their own dances. And so they would have had to be learning European tunes, Celtic tunes or whatever, you know, for these dances. And then, you know, these homegrown tunes are starting to come out, and then there's mixing, and, you know, it's just, it's American.
Well, and that's it. That when you talk about this service to the community, it's because it internalized, takes in so much of that, and then feeds it back, and then changes. Amazing stuff. So then you talked about Dom Flemons and Justin Robinson, the original Chocolate Drops. How did you all meet?
We met at the Black Banjo Gathering. You know, I met Dom and I met Justin. They didn't meet. You know, Justin was only there for half a day, and then Dom moved over from Arizona to this area, and then you know we started going down to see Joe, and that's really where the Carolina Chocolate Drops came from, was playing with Joe, and the original repertoire was mostly his stuff and some stuff that Justin brought, you know, to the band, and it was very focused around him.
What was your vision for the band?
You know, really to play Joe's music and to educate. You know, we mentioned that in an article in The Independent, and then we got all these phone calls from schools who wanted us to come, and we started doing school shows. And, you know, I really think, you know, starting out that way was just a really great way to do it, because, you know, we were serving the music always, you know, and trying to tell, you know, we started getting these, we would do performance, then people would go, well, you know, how did y'all get into this music? You know, what they mean was, how did you black people get into this music? And so you start explaining, and then you'd want to preempt that, so you end the show, you start going, well, the banjo is an African-American instrument, blah blah blah, and so that kind of like changes how things go. And you know, and I was a talker and Dom was a talker anyway, so it was a natural kind of thing.
On the State of Things today, my guest is Greensboro musician and now musician to the world, Rhiannon Giddens, co-founder of the Carolina Chocolate Drop. She's going to play at Chafer Center for the Performing Arts in Boone on the 24th, and then she'll be in Durham on the 25th. We always have that at our website, and our conversation continues on the State of Things. Please stay tuned.
If you see that gal of mine, you tell her if you can. Push girl to make my bread, wash your left hand. Get her.
This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. My guest, Rhiannon Giddens. She's a musician from Greensboro who co-founded the Grammy-winning band, the Carolina Chocolate Drops. Talking about your career and the formation of the Chocolate Drops, and you said that, you know, initially it was to try to carry on Joe Thompson's music. It had a real educational foundation. You won a Grammy in 2011, so at some point people started to notice. When did you start seeing yourself as that kind of band?
I don't know. It just kind of like things kind of took off, you know? I mean, we were just trying to keep up with it, honestly. And I don't really think we had time to think about that. We were all pretty, you know, for a while, pretty heavy on keeping it very traditional and stuff, you know? And I think that that was, you know, I think that was a really good thing that we were able to keep it that way for as long as we did, because there, you know, we were sounding a note for that music, and you know, that just didn't have very many champions at that time.
But that's a hard thing to do, isn't it? When you talk about tradition or authentic, I mean, any of that is a living music. This music was constantly evolving, and so how do you become both the sort of living, breathing embodiment and also the museum? I mean, that's a hard.
Oh, you never want to be the museum. That's right. The thing, you know. And we were always really clear about the fact that we are 21st century people playing this music. We don't play like Joe. We can't, because we didn't grow up with Joe. You know, we didn't grow up in that community. So we have learned all that we can learn from Joe, and then it kind of gets filtered through our experience. You know, so doing things like Hit 'Em Up Style, and, you know, as well as doing, you know, Boodly Bum Bum, or, you know, any of Joe's tunes, it's like that's our experience. And, you know, and we never really, we went with the arrangement that felt right, not the one that felt old or new. We went with what felt right. And that's all you can do, really, you know, because it's really important to not try to say, oh, you know, we're playing like this, you know, this person. Because, I mean, Joe was 86 when we met him. Like, who knows what he played like when he was 18? You know, it's a total guessing game. So all you have is what you have, you know?
Will you play a banjo tune for us now?
I will. This is actually not a traditional tune at all. This is a song that I wrote after reading slavery narratives, because I've been really interested in the history of where this music comes from. I play, this is a replica of a banjo from 1858, an exact replica, and I really love the sound of this, and I thought, you know, this story between, this conversation between an enslaved woman and her mistress as the Union Army is coming over a hill. I read about this in a book, and it just seemed to want to become a song, so...
Julie is an original song written by my guest, Rhiannon Giddens, whose latest record is Tomorrow Is My Turn. It's a beautiful song, a bittersweet beautiful song. Tell me about now, when you're working on your solo career, the Drops are still together. Mm-hmm. Dom and Justin are no longer members. Mm-hmm. And you're doing solo stuff. What combination of original work and traditional stuff, the reinterpretations, are you comfortable with? Where do you see yourself going?
You know, I'm going where the music is leading. You know, I mean, it's cliched, but it's true. You can't really be attached to any outcomes, you know, as an artist. You have to follow where your muse is leading. And right now, you know, this idea of, you know, that Julie is, a, you know, from a set of six reimagined sort of African-American folk songs. Like, you know, if you could have said what you wanted to say back in the day, you know, that kind of idea, you know. So I don't really know. You know, I do know that I'm discovering my voice. You know, I've been an interpreter for a long time, and I feel really strongly about the art of interpretation and not losing that. And I never want to, you know, I never want to be releasing albums full, you know, full of my originals. Like, there's people who do that, and there's plenty of it, you know?
You've given me the sense that you're on a mission, that you feel called to do this.
Yeah, I mean, when I got approached by T-Bone Burnett to do the solo record, because I had no plan on doing, you know, I was working on another Chocolate Drops record, and just reformed the band after Dom left, and, you know, that was my plan. And it was just kind of one of these things where it was just like, this is an opportunity here. Clearly the universe is presenting to me. What am I going to do? Like, shut the door in its face? That's not going to come again.
T-Bone Burnett, you talked about him, of course, played with Dylan as a producer in his own right. You worked on a project called Another Day, Another Time.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
I mean, that's where my life changed, for sure. That's where everything kind of that's happening now has its genesis there. You know, it was a concert celebrating the music that inspired the movie Inside Llewyn Davis, which was kind of a, you know, Greenwich Village, like, folk revival, you know, movie. And so I took it, you know, he invited me to be a part of that. And I wanted to represent Odetta. You know, I really wanted her, at least a piece, you know, nobody can be Odetta, but just a little piece of, you know, her spirit, try to evoke that, you know, can't be that, but try to evoke it. I didn't know it was going to change my life quite like it did.
You did a song called Waterboy as part of that, and we actually have a clip of that, not from the original performance, but when you did Letterman a few months ago.
If you don't come right here, I'm gonna tear upon you. There ain't no hammer that's on this mountain that ring like mine, boy. That ring. Bust this rock, boy, from here to Macon, all the way to the jail, boy, all the way to the...
That's Rhiannon Giddens performing the song Waterboy in The Late Show with David Letterman. By the way, he's no longer with the show, and the rumor is that he was holding out until you performed on his show. Then he could retire.
That's funny.
That's what I'm told. I don't know if it's true, but anyway, that was a few. So we're talking about working with T-Bone Burnett as well, and you're still working with him, right? You're working, or you've worked on other projects.
Yeah,
right?
We did something called the New Basement Tapes, which was setting music to these long lost sort of Dylan lyrics rejects, I suppose. But you know, even Dylan rejects are better than most people's, you know, alpha lyrics. I did that with like, you know, Elvis Costello, Marcus Mumford, you know, the guy. Taylor Goldsmith from Dawes and Jim James from My Morning Jacket. It was a real wow.
Well, I mean, what is that like? Because, again, you're working with a lot of artists who are pretty well known, working with material, as you say, from a pretty well known guy. So that's a lot of collaboration, if you think about
it. Yeah. And, you know, and I'm a collaborator. That's what attracted me to the project when, you know, T-Bone was talking to me about it. I was like, that sounds awesome. Yeah. You know, getting in there, it was very different.
Was it hard? I mean,
it was very hard. I mean, yeah. I was the only woman, the only person of color, and I was the only really non-songwriter. I'd written a few songs, but like, and I was the only traditionalist. You know, I was coming in with a fiddle and a banjo, and they have like mellotrons and electric guitars and drums and all this stuff that, you know, instruments I never, you know, you know, I'm exposed to. And so it was just a lot of, you know, I'd been in this black string band for 9 years, and all of a sudden I'm in this completely foreign, you know, sort of, so I had to overcome a lot of insecurities to do it. And they were all wonderful to me. It was just, I had to overcome myself.
Okay. Would you play another song for us now?
I will. I'll sing one for you. This is called Factory Girl. And this is a kind of the songs that I had been writing up until like the New Basement Tapes project were a lot of, you know, more like traditional songs that I was kind of, you know, changing. And this is a traditional song that I changed to reflect, you know, what happened in Bangladesh when that factory collapsed, the Rana Plaza factory, and over 1,000 people died, 2,500 people were injured, making our cheap clothing. And so this is Factory Girl.
As I
went a-walking on a fine summer's morning. The birds in the bushes did whistle and sing. The lads and the lassies in couples were sporting. And then back to the factory, their work to begin. I spied one amongst them, she was fairer than any. Her cheeks like the roses that bloom in the spring. Her skin like the lily that blooms in yon valley. She was only a hard-working factory girl. I stepped up to her, more closely to view her. When on me she cast a look of disdain, saying, young man, stand off me and do not come near me. I work for my living and think it no shame. The next morning I was there, ready and waiting, and bade her to talk to me, if just for a spell. And each morning after, she lingered still longer, and then hurried away at the sound of the bell. Then came the morning when silence did greet me. The birds in the bushes were stricken and still. I stepped on the path where she often did greet me, and I walked to the factory up on the hill. The crowd gathered round, couldn't hide the destruction. I cast my eyes on it in such disbelief. A truth of the world settled into the ashes. A rich man's neglect is the poor man's grief. As I stood there, a whisper caressed me. Soft scent of roses, my senses begun. I lifted my face and I saw that above me, a thousand young butterflies darkened the sun.
Factory Girl, a song by Rhiannon Giddens, my guest today on The State of Things. I sensed a kind of Celtic root in that song. Have you explored your Celtic roots in the same way that you have the string band?
I learned that from a recording of Margaret Berry, who was an Irish traveler, and she played five-string banjo in this very unique style and had this enormous voice, and then I changed all the words. But there's a lot of that in American music, and I've always been really interested. My name is Welsh, and I've always been interested in that culture. But then getting into the Irish music, the Scottish music, you know, I was in a local Celtic band, Gael Wind, you know, quite a while, and that was really important to the formation of me as a musician. And just learning Scots Gaelic, you know, really getting into that culture, because there was, you know, such a huge settlement of Scots Gaels in the Cape Fear region in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't know that. All of them think it's where the Highland games are in the western part of the state, but that's actually not where they settled. And you know, there's this, you know, legacy of Gaelic culture in North Carolina, and so of course I'm interested in that. You know, it's North Carolina, so yeah, I'm gonna learn it. Bring it on.
It's been a great pleasure to talk with you. Thank you, Rhiannon. Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Greensboro musician and now musician of the world, Rhiannon Giddens, co-founder of the string band The Carolina Chocolate Drops, on the road right now as a solo artist performing at the Schaefer Center for the Performing Arts in Boone, Thursday, September 24th, Page Auditorium in Durham, Friday, on the 25th. And you can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director with help from Al Wadarski today. Andrew Tyes, the intern, WUNC's news director, is Brent Wolf. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio. Once again, Rhiannon Giddens.
City, I was on the run, blinded by my own pity. I was nearly done. Stark, heartbroken, bitter and poor, burdened down by sin. I fought hard to find the door, didn't know how to get in. Time and time at hand, you helped me over the sand, gently rising to be. You walked a mile with me, and I saw sea. I'm found where I was lost. I'm closer to free. Heart unbound, whatever the cost, all rivers fall to the sea. Time and time at hand, you helped me over the sand, gently rising to be. You walked a mile with me, and I saw the sea. Me over the sand, gently rising to be. You walked a mile with me, and I saw.